Welcome to Human Lab, the science between us. This is Amy Alcon, science-based, nationally syndicated columnist and your host. Stay tuned for a very interesting half hour with my guest, evolutionary psychologist Dr. Catherine Salmon, here to discuss our family relationships, including those we have with our family members, with Paws, one of whom is sitting right below me. Now, some of you may have seen pictures of my five-pound beloved little dog, Aida, who is named for Verity's Nubian princess. Aida is a Chinese crested. What's a Chinese crested, you ask? Well, basically, while dogs are said to be descended from wolves, she looks like she's descended from My Little Pony. And in that, let's just say dogs and cats have come a long way with we humans throughout evolutionary history. And in so many families now, they're an integral part of the family. We're going to talk about our evolved relationship with dogs and cats tonight, along with our relationships with our human family members, with evolutionary psychologist Dr. Catherine Salmon. The book we'll be discussing is one she edited and wrote some fascinating chapters for, along with fellow evolutionary psychologist Todd Shackelford, and it's the Oxford Handbook of Evolutionary Family Psychology. Hello, Catherine.
Hello.
Hey, you are fresh from cat rescue, so you know about all of these kinds of families firsthand. And now what's interesting is so much of our psychology and so much of our attention is focused on non-family relationships, like romantic relationships. Mm-hmm. But our psychology is modeled on family relationships because that's how we evolved in these big extended families. So it really is important to look at these family relationships to understand ourselves socially. And the thing I got reading your book is that family encompasses much more than we think of it doing. And I want to talk about that in relation to both pets and family relationships. And I'll just start by saying I compete with my dog in some ways, which is kind of embarrassing and a little crazy. But let's go to humans to understand interfamily competition.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the points you made, I think that it's also a really good point for people to think about is the importance of understanding family dynamics and family relationships in terms of how it applies to all of our other relationships. Because a lot of the history of psychology has been the history of non-family relationships. When we form our models for how we're going to deal with relationships when we're small children within these sort of family settings. And when you talk about, you know, competing with, you know, your dog for your boyfriend's attention. One of the things that is a big part of family that we sometimes don't think of is this aspect of competition. And the fact of the matter is that there's lots of different levels of competition within the family. There's competition that I think many people are familiar with, which is sibling competition. If you have a bunch of children in the family, and there's always jockeying for territory, jockeying for space, jockeying over, you know, who has the rights to the computer at this time or the PlayStation at that time and who gets the bigger piece of cake. And so there's a lot of that sort of sibling competition that then prepares people for peer competition when they're outside the family. But there's also competition between spouses, and there's also competition that happens between parents and offspring. So there are multiple levels of competition that happen within the family that are all worth investigating for better understanding not only how we live in our families, but how we live in our, in our non-familial relationships.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And I think what people don't really realize that we know from reading of Psych is that this is resource competition. You're competing with for resources with your sibling, mm-hmm. even with your spouse. And the really fascinating thing is that there's competition for resources that starts in the womb.
That often freaks people out when they think about that, because we have this image of, you know, mother and child as this perfect harmonious relationship. You know, baby can't survive without mom. Mom has all this incredible sort of attachment to the child. But from the child's perspective, they often would like more resources than is maybe in mom's best interest to give, because that probably isn't going to be the only child that she's going to have. And she might be interested in keeping some resources for herself, resources for other children. But babies often put greater demands, and some of the health problems that women can run into when they're pregnant, like pregnancy diabetes and preeclampsia and blood pressure problems, are because of the baby, in a sense, winning the competition for resources with mom.
Yeah, that's a problem. Don't kill the mom. You can go too far with that winning thing.
Well, you can, actually, and of course that sometimes can actually you know, put mom and baby at risk, right? So, I mean, ideally, you get a proper balance of things there where baby gets enough and mom, you know, manages to keep things under control. But sometimes, you know, sometimes it doesn't work that way. And you see other kinds of competition between mother and baby after birth, right, when you wean children, you stop breastfeeding. And, you know, the baby doesn't really want to stop breastfeeding, and so you've got a kid trailing you around trying to grab at your breast when you're out in the shopping mall. And I had a friend who had that kind of problem where her kid would come up and go, milk, and pull at her shirt, you know, which is fine. But, like, you know, when the child's 3 and 4 and you're out in public, people start thinking something odd's going on.
That's really funny. And actually, I remember Steve Gollan and William Lasik did research that where they said that the bimbo body, so the big hips, it's called gynoid fat, that's the most protective, big hips, big boobs, of the mother's intelligence and physical resources during pregnancy. And that was a shocking thing to learn, that these things can get depleted. The baby's basically a nasty little parasite in some sense.
Well, you know, also nutrition comes from mom, right? They don't really have any other choice. So they really are dependent on her. And so it's not surprising that especially in situations where mom might not have, you know, I mean, in a lot of Western, you know, populations, food resources are pretty unlimited. But if you live in parts of the world where it's not that way, or historically when it wasn't that way, that kind of fat was really important, because otherwise you might not make it through your pregnancy successfully.
Yeah, that's a really important thing to remember, the evolutionary environment, that it wasn't, you know, there weren't Costcos all over the place during those times, and that we're adapted for that.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's a very interesting term that I saw in your book. It's called fictive kinship. What is fictive kinship?
Okay, well, fictive kinship is basically what they're referring to are individuals that are not related by birth or marriage, but they label and treat each other as kin. So one of the terms that would describe this that's probably familiar to a lot of people who'd be listening is godparenting, right? When you refer to somebody as your godfather or your godmother, and they have a relationship to that child that is pseudo-parental, and if anything happened to the parents, they might be the ones that take over. And that would be an example of fictive kinship, where there might be no biological ties, but you might have those kinds of relationships. And there are many researchers who've looked at things like, you know, brothers-in-arms types of relationships in the military, and, you know, the terminology that people use to refer to each other when they belong to gangs or sororities and fraternities. But there's lots of organizations and situations where people will use kin terminology and use it to sort of represent or reinforce relationships that are supposed to be similar in that way to real, you know, biological kinship relationships, where there's an expectation that you would, you know, have the other person's best interests at heart.
Well, we look at reciprocity and evolution, and that you're giving something and you're going to get something back. If you're giving to your kin, and this is pointed out throughout your book, that you're helping your genes go forward into future generations. But what do godparents get out of it?
Well, typically there could be a number of different things, but one of them is that, again, it reinforces ties between people outside of a family network. And some of this kind of fictive kinship is probably even more common today than it might have even been ancestrally, although I suspect that with the risk of people, you know, dying historically from natural causes as well as unnatural causes, like somebody putting a, you know, arrow through your head, that there might have been needs for having those kinds of relationships in the past as well. But today, a lot of people don't live close to their families. They often, you know, don't really have that sort of family support structure, so they build other family support structures. And even though it's not like it's not always reciprocal in the sense of somebody always, you know, sort of keeping track of things in a sense, there is the expectation that if somebody needs help, if you claim that kind of relationship, that the other person will help you.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And you talk about in the book, there's a mention of a Clark McCauley, research by Clark McCauley, where he talks about, you know, some not nice things, like not the sororities and fraternities, and it's terrorist armies, cults, drug treatment centers, these things that separate people from their families, that it's very important for them to create substitute families. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, if you're trying to create an organization, let's just refer to them as organizations. If you're trying to create an organization that has an agenda and you want to try and make people give it the investment that they would normally have given to family ties, you definitely want to separate them from their own families because you want their allegiance to be your organization, not to their biological family or something like that. So if you look at like the history of lots of different kinds of organizations, but particularly religious ones, and people get uncomfortable when you draw this comparison sometimes, but religious ones and then also ones that are terrorist-oriented, which may not necessarily be religious. Some of them might be. But they often recruit children very young, right? So they're recruiting kids that, you know, are prepubertal. They're creating, you know, this sort of structured relationship where they have older same-sex mentors that are acting like older brothers. And they may even use terminology like older brother to refer to the sort of hierarchy of command within their group. If you look at it in terms of religion, you could look at it in terms of the Catholic Church and having priests who are referred to as father and, you know, the Holy Father, and having nuns that are referred to as sister or the Holy Mother. So you have all these different kinds of terminology that are replicating family relationships. And it's not like that they're like fooling people into thinking that this person has that exact relationship, but it's a way of reinforcing the idea that these people are, you know, part of your group, part of your in-group. They're the solitary people who have your best interest at heart that you should be willing to do things for.
The kind of things that you would do for family, it makes sense to die for family. Mm-hmm. So even though you don't, you know that you're not genetically related to these people.
Sure.
People are, they don't assume that, but, you know, you see the kin of bombers getting a reward. So there is reward that goes back to their actual real families.
There can be rewards that go back to the real families. And then the other thing is that if you use those terminologies and you create those kind of relationships, you activate those kinds of emotions, right? You activate the same kinds of emotions that they would have towards family. So even though they might not be getting the genetic benefit that they might if they were sacrificing themselves for their family, you know, obviously in some cases there may be financial benefits to their families. But the idea behind it is that it's triggering that same kind of psychology so that the feelings that you have, those feelings of caring and the idea that you guys are united against the common enemy kind of thing, the band of brothers aspect of it, that those things are triggered by creating these kinds of situations where you mimic those kinds of relationships. And also it's a good way to get people to actually, especially if you start them when they're young, people to follow your authority figures. Because that's kind of what we do with kids, right? I mean, while we often pay a lot of lip service to the idea that we want kids to be independent and we want them to question, parents really don't want them to question everything, right? Because you don't want the kids to question you when you tell him not to play in the street or when you tell him not to pick up the hot pan on the stove, right? So you want a certain amount of following authority in the hierarchy. And if you tap into that aspect of people's psychology, then that can give you an organization where people are often quite obedient and don't question whether the people who are in charge have the right idea or not.
And that's a great point about these mechanisms that get triggered, which brings me to pets. So talk about that. Mm-hmm. It seems that some of that's going on with their fictive kinship with pets.
Yeah, pets are really interesting, and there's a lot of sort of different sort of perspectives that people take in looking at you know, the sort of relationship between people and their pets. One of the things to think about and why there's a lot of especially recent interest in looking at this is that over 90% of pet-owning Americans consider their pets are part of their family, and 75% of them say they view them in the same way that they do their own children. You know, almost 70% of them share the bed with their pets. They buy them birthday presents. They buy them Christmas presents. They will stock all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, so there's certainly an awful lot of people who are engaging in fictive kinship or engaging in these kinds of family relationships with their pets. And so when we think about the psychology that's getting triggered here, obviously, if many people think or they view their pets as children or being like their children, there's a lot of parental psychology that may be getting picked up, the caretaking part of psychology that's activated by pets. And there are some specific interesting adaptations that are worth talking about just in terms of that, in terms of how we've bred animals to be a certain way and how the animals themselves may have changed in order to take advantage of it. But there's also a certain amount of pet and animal ownership that has more of a sort of friendship or, buddy kind of aspect to it as well. And so I think probably both are worth talking about. I know one of the ones that people often find really interesting in terms of pets, particularly cats and dogs, has to do with these sort of adaptations on the part of animals, some of which we have probably bred into them, that activate our desire to take care of things. So we often talk about how a lot of domesticated animals, particularly dogs and cats, some of the ones that people have the strongest reactions to are the ones that look like puppies forever, as you mentioned your dog.
Yes, little dog.
Yes, your little dog, which has that little tidy puppy look forever, right? I mean, so we'll always, elicit that sort of nurturing of that childlike aspect. But if you look at, there were some studies that have done that have looked at dogs and looked at features that we look at when we look at neoteny in human faces, like big eyes, and like a, small chin, just different things about the shape of their face. And these sort of broader face dogs often that have these really big eyes, it's like little spaniel puppies and things like that. People go completely gaga over them, and then they start talking to them as though they're children, right? They start using motherese, and it's like, oh, my little baby, you're so sweet. And it's like their voices jump like two octaves.
Right. And I just want to explain neoteny. Neoteny is looking like babies. And actually, very interestingly, men are attracted to neotenous features in women. So the big eyes, the small chin, sort of like puppies. It's sort of interesting, the parallel there.
Well, sure. Although one hopes it's not that strong a parallel. But in terms of the idea that, it's very clear that youthfulness, right, just generally, youthfulness is attractive to men in women because of its connection with fertility. But if you think about infant faces and infant needs, they need a lot of care, they need a lot of attention. And if you have features in animals, dogs that tend to stay looking like puppies for their whole lives, even as older adult dogs, they're going to keep triggering that same caretaking thing in their owners. And even some cats, cats, some people will say, well, cats are cats, but there's been a lot of breeding that's happened in the last, probably 20 years. And you have even breeds like Scottish Folds, which have little folded over ears and really round faces and big eyes. And so they look really like little kittens, even when they're full grown. And I think that, again, it's something that stimulates their owners to want to, invest more and take care of them more. And so it's one way, for people who view the pet relationship sometimes in a costly light to humans, they would say, well, it's just one of the ways in which pets manipulate their owners, to have this kind of an appearance. But I suspect that it's also satisfying a psychological need for many humans to take care of something else. And it's probably one of the reasons why you see so many single or childless couples that have, often more than one pet, because they're, they're creating their own family. It's just, as they say, it's a furry family.
Right. And I know that my dog makes me a better person. You have to be compassionate, especially when you have a puppy and the puppy doesn't know what it's doing and it pees in the wrong place and does all this stuff. You really have to be patient. And so there's an aspect, so pets are very costly on one side, but on the other side, like you're saying, it's there's a signaling aspect here for people to show other people, I don't particularly, I never wanted children, but if I did, I could show someone, I think, that I'd be a very good mother by how I take care of my dog.
Right. And I think that from that sort of signaling perspective, there's certainly there's more than little evidence that males actually are aware of this and use this kind of strategy, so that men, single men will often have a dog, take that dog out for walks in places where there are going to be women. And there have been a couple studies where they've had, the experimenter go out and ask for, girls' phone numbers, and they're much more likely to get them if they have a dog.
But the same guy.
The same guy. But having a dog makes them seem more approachable, less like a serial killer, maybe. I mean, it makes them seem like a nicer person, or a more compassionate person, maybe. But I think also for women, if the animal looks happy and healthy, they may be thinking, well, if he's good at taking care of his dog, maybe he'd be good at being a dad as well.
And pets give us a lot. So there's a whole section in your book about how pets are sources of social support, and that pet owners seem to be more resilient and have fewer physiological problems, like cardiovascular disease.
Right. Well, there have been some studies done that have looked at the benefits of pet ownership. And, I mean, they vary in quality, and ideally you'd have more longitudinal studies where you've looked at people who've owned pets their whole lives, or maybe even ones who only had pets early in their life, and look at whether it has lasting effects. But there's certainly some data that shows that people who have pets, when they spend time with their pets, it has beneficial physiological effects in terms of things like lowered blood pressure, for example. Some of that is behind the movement to have pets in, say, nursing homes, to make more efforts to have senior assisted living places that allow pets so that people can keep their pets with them, that also include things like using dogs in therapy. A lot of that has to do with those kind of effects. And certainly there's some data that suggests that in some studies done looking at people who've come back from wartime that have had great difficulty adjusting and problems with PTSD, that pairing them with a dog companion actually has huge benefits for them. And it probably does it in two ways, probably because there's a relaxing effect that people have when they're with their pet, but also for them, they were used to having, their band of brothers to watch their back when they were in the field, and now they're home and there's no one to watch their back, and the dog then becomes like their brothers in arms were for them. And so they can get that kind of a benefit from that relationship as well. And I mean, for the dog, that's a great relationship, because dogs are at their happiest when they can be with you all day long because they're pack animals. It's a little different. Cats are usually better, they are much better at being on their own more, but dogs are usually not so happy with that.
Well, that brings me to a question I know people want answered. Who are cat people and who are dog people?
Yeah, I mean, there's some stuff out there on that, there are slightly more, interestingly enough, men that are dog people and women that are cat people. There are also lots of people that like both. They're people like me. It's like pretty much any animal is okay. I mean, I probably wouldn't keep a bird as a pet, but pretty much anything else I think is cute at some level. But there certainly are some people who have much stronger feelings about it. And sometimes it also has to do with the utility of the dog. So it's not even, or the cat, it's not just the emotional thing. It's whether they see them as having other functions as well. So whether part of it how much of it is companionship versus, whether the dog is also serving as a guardian, whether the cat is also serving as rodent control, what the different sort of functions are as well. But I think, you see quite a bit of variety, but you also see quite a bit of overlap, I think more than people sometimes think, where you have a lot more homes where there are dogs and cats living in the same home.
Yeah, I guess people are animal people, and I just realized part of that's probably some people can have a dog in their apartment or, various kinds of animals. When I was growing up, I was only allowed to have a hamster, even though I wanted a dog, so there was Squeaky instead of Barky when I was a kid.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. And if people travel a lot for work, a dog is not, if you can't take the dog with you, then it's not as practical because they don't do well left on their own for long periods of time. And even cats don't, you know, I mean, if you're only gone for a day or two, it's probably not a big problem, but long periods of time are going to bother them too. Under those circumstances, then maybe you do need a bird and you need somebody to come in and take care of it. But many of them, you know, people's decisions can be influenced that and by allergies. There are people who have allergies to cats who like cats but can't have cats. There are people who end up with, you know, certain types of breeds of animal because they affect their allergies less. So, I mean, one of the things about that, though, is that people who do that, despite their allergies, are showing how much commitment they really have to their pets. Because I know people who go and get allergy shots all the time so that they can keep their pets.
Yeah, that's incredible. And that's a costly signal that they're willing to go that far. And now, dogs, I read in one of your chapters, and I think I know this, dogs are more into being petted than cats are. And the chapter talks about how there's a longer coevolutionary history with dogs and humans than there is in cats. So how does that change the kind of relationships we as humans have with them?
Sure. If you think about the sort of the history of the domestication of the dog and that, and as you say, the really long coevolutionary history that humans had with dogs, that started, you know, way, way back where dogs were hanging around human encampments and, you know, scavenging from, you know, remnants of kills, but also then helping humans hunt, you had, you know, a kind of system where the dogs were selecting, so the dogs that were the most social and the most friendly and maybe the most fearless as far as humans went were the ones who spent the most time around, the ones that formed the bonds, that got the advantages, they did better than the other dogs. And so the dogs were sort of, in a sense, being selected by that environment, right, to become more and more like the kinds of dogs that would be able to live close to humans and do well with humans. And then humans, of course, interacted the most with the friendliest and most outgoing puppies. And then you get this sort of, you know, coevolution of the species together for what they need. But that relationship, because it founded itself in early days in hunting, is quite long between humans and dogs. And dogs are very social. They're a pack animal. And so humans become part of the pack. And so they want a lot of interaction. They can be much more demanding as far as a pet goes in terms of them being happiest when they're with you a lot. And some dogs end up with, you know, separation anxiety because if you have one dog and you leave them alone too much, the dogs really are not happy because it doesn't fit their psychology. Their psychology is to be part of a group. If you look at other species that we have long histories with but maybe not as long, like cats, right, when you started having grain being stored and cats were quite useful to have around because they kept the rodent population down. You look back at Egypt and there's evidence of you know, them keeping cats and being very attached to them and having the cats buried with people. You know, again, you're seeing that kind of relationship. But it is a little bit different because cats are not as social as dogs. Most cats tended to be, you know, if you look at wild cats, other than lions, they tend to be pretty solitary. And even domestic cats, sometimes they'll get along with another cat, but a lot of times they won't. And so they can be a little bit more, you know, a little bit more standoffish, I guess, in terms of our relationship with them. And then you can look at other types of species as well, like horses that we have a really long history with, but it was very much a working history with them carrying you know, people into carrying men into battle you know, allowing for the movement of people over great distances in Europe. That kind of relationship, too, is kind of interesting because horses, again, are not as they're a prey animal. Dogs and cats are not in that way. They tend to be the predators, but horses are prey. And so they get something different from their relationship with humans. Humans are a protector for them. The problem is that, you know, for many people, they sometimes find out, much to their chagrin, that horses are big and nervous sometimes. That's not always a good combination. So
right.
That's one of the things where it's really important. The bond, actually, between the owner and the horse, between the human and the horse, is really important because horses can do a lot of damage if they're frightened. And the onus is partially on the human rider to make sure that that doesn't happen, to give them that. But I mean, on the other hand, you know, there's lots of evidence that the relationships between humans and horses, that humans get a lot out of that. And I think it's because humans have to work hard at that one. Getting a relationship with a dog is fairly easy. Dogs are sort of almost wired to love you as long
right.
as you're, you know, half decent at all. And the fact that dogs that have been involved in fight rings and things like that love humans despite what's been done to them is testament to the fact that they're so hardwired to form bonds. It's not so much like that with cats. If cats have been mistreated, they often don't react well, and horses can be the same because they're not as they're not forming the same kind of bond in the same way that dogs do. It's kind of like the joke that if you were a cat owner and you know you died of natural causes, the cat would actually eat you. Your dog probably wouldn't do it, you know, but the cat would probably do it and might not even wait that long.
This is why I have a dog. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you so much. I've been talking with evolutionary psychologist Catherine Salmon. Her book is The Oxford Handbook of Evolutionary Family Psychology. Oh, it's Dr. Catherine Salmon. I don't want to not give you your doctor. But I know your cat doesn't care about that. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.